Welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your radio reading service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter from my beloved monster, Masha the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me by Caleb Carr, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to start today's readings with My Beloved Monster by Caleb Carr. In the last chapter, we had learned that Caleb had a very serious pain in his chest, which required surgery. That made him have to leave the home for approximately 4 days. While he was gone, Masha was unable to console herself. But when Caleb returned, she was acting quite strangely. Chapter 19, title, Echoes. Soon after I staggered across the finish line to college degree, I decided to take an honest shot at a career at my mentor's think tank while living uptown. But being a gifted young interloper at such a place, I soon discovered, was very different from being an enlisted man. I morphed from breath of fresh air to misfit in the ossified world of the East Coast foreign policy establishment, especially given my strong and occasionally published objections to certain of the tank's key members. My mentor's bosses began to agitate for my departure, and I, more than a bit confused, quit, headed back downtown to my grandmother's, and set about finishing my first book. But for several hours each day I gained a change of work venue by writing in a small corner of a loft across town that my father had bought in its raw state, then drafted his three sons and a few of our friends into helping him renovate it. My brothers and I all had our own motives for undertaking the labor. Mine was that it seemed to justify my asking for the corner, and further, that my father stay off my back while I used it. He never could comply with the second request, but if I worked fast enough, I found I could usually get out before he returned from his job, avoiding trouble. In addition, there was one resident of the place who made the deal especially bearable. He'd been born only months earlier in a parking lot for commercial trucks behind my father's loft. His mother had been a mostly Abyssinian mix who'd belonged to my father's second wife and whose choice of such a seemingly perilous spot in which to give birth had in fact been wise. My father had always had a taste for bringing home small, nasty dogs who tended to nip and bite at everyone and everything but my dad. And he had not one but two such animals when I began writing in the loft. Obviously, newborn kittens would not have been a safe place there. The pretty but careful mother cat possessed very characteristic and elegant Abyssinian markers, as did the two kittens who eventually were allowed to stay, one a big male, strikingly handsome, the other the runt of what had been a larger litter, the rest of whom were either given away or had run off. The runt was simply called Echo, because of his resemblance to his mother, but being a runt, he was not, in that household, paid much other than hostile attention until I started writing in my corner. During those sessions, little Echo, as he was almost always rather tauntingly known in that place, and I became fast friends, and I had been as informed about such things as I was when I met Masha. I would have recognized that Echo's selection of me as his friend and protector was rooted in psychological similarities of the kind that cats are so able and quick to grasp. Each day he'd appear eagerly, bounding up and down and then onto my lap. Once ensconced in the spot, where he would stay for as long as I worked, he developed the habit of stuffing his face into my shirt front pocket. It wasn't a game. He didn't keep it there and then pull it out as if trying to surprise me. No, he stayed there for as long as I would allow him, drilling in deeper with his muzzle. At first I thought it was akin to the trait falsely attributed to ostriches, of burying their heads to avoid detection. But soon I came to think that Echo believed if he stayed out of sight, ab the loft, for long enough, perhaps when he pulled his head out he might find himself somewhere else entirely. On a basic level, certainly, he was glad for the protection of a friend, and in winter months when I would wear a heavy woolen jacket while working next to the loft's frigid plate glass windows, Echo would ask that I zip him up inside, where he would sleep warmly and entirely hidden. He really was about as good-hearted and devoted a little companion as would have been possible to imagine, and just at that point in my life I was very much in need of such. A semi-unemployed, mostly unproven and dependent writer is rarely admired, especially when secondary activities like forming and rehearsing with a band are involved. Nor did the part-time job inspire confidence. It was in a bookstore, just a couple of blocks from my grandmother's, where I was a come-and-go employee who complained frequently to our manager, a taciturn black Muslim from Brooklyn and one of the best people I've ever known, about his consigning those of us with college educations, in a bit of unintended irony, to the basement of the store. There we worked with hardcover classics and remainders, cheap overflow from publisher stock. The manager would listen patiently, time and again, to my plea that we Morlocks below deserved to be given more sun and social amusement that the Eloi above got to enjoy. He even sympathized, but he also told me repeatedly that he had to depend upon us to do the more specialized job. Clearly, I'd only found one more place where I didn't really belong. Eventually, what looked, at least initially, like vindication for my lifestyle arrived. After many months of voicing my concern about life to Echo, who, being an Abyssinian, had many chatty answers for me, the draft of my now completed novel was accepted by a respected editor at a big publishing house. The acceptance was provisional on certain plot changes, but I, eager to get into the print game at last, told the editor I was sure that I'd be able to live with any changes. As it turned out, there were a big pill to swallow, but you can't call yourself a writer if you don't publish, was how I understood it to work. Though I would later regret the compromises, you can't obsess over the flaws in an edifice's first block of stone. You have to consider the entire structure, and without that first block, the rest cannot be built. News of the book's acceptance brought an improved atmosphere that delighted my workday companion. I don't pretend that Echo understood precisely what the turn of these events meant, any more than I would have later argued that Masha understood precisely what I was trying to do by enlarging her to a big cat and making her the allegorical focal point of my medieval book. But cats understand several key things of which writers' lives are made: stress, focus, and a lonely persistence in the face of emotional or physical torment. All of these are central elements of feline and writerly consciousness and experience. And it's never surprised me that so many writers have chosen cats as companions. The money from the book was enough to let me know and that I could move into a railroad flat on a busy, fairly decrepit street on the Lower East Side, a neighborhood I never could shake. But things seemed to be looking up. My girlfriend at the time decided to move in, although she was not particularly keen to see that Echo was already there. My father had more or less demanded that I take the little fellow with me, though I'd already thought of it and was happy to agree. And whatever our fortunes after that, I don't think Echo ever looked back to his days of ducking nasty dogs, his unkind mother and brother, or the drunken humans in that loft that, like anything, like nostalgia. Initially, my romantic relationship, too, seemed to go well. But soon enough, a problem appeared. True to long habit, Echo came every day and jumped up onto my lap while I was working, sticking his head into my pocket. Each time he did, I could feel resentment and eventually rage stewing in my girlfriend, until it was only a matter of time before I heard the door of our apartment slam as she left for good. My writing hours, she later explained, shut her out, and much of my remaining time seemed devoted to things other than her. Music, as she put it bitterly, your cat. There was some justification in critique, no doubt, but Echo and I were living as we'd longed dreamed of doing and weren't about to make any radical changes. And so it was just my cat and me in that apartment for as long as we could last, which wasn't long at all. The book went nowhere upon publication, and I soon followed suit, after which it was back to Washington Square for me and Echo. Initially, he was delighted, quickly coming to share the comfort I took from the quiet permanence of my grandmother's. Other things, however, did not care for, as I soon found out. For my grandmother, having a cat around was an adjustment, certainly, but she grew fond of the newcomer, who, having long since displayed the Abyssinian tendency to chat quite conversationally, gave her lonely soul someone to talk to. In fact, the only flaw in the new arrangement was me. I was back to writing at the Washington Square now, and that meant hearing about my refusal to adopt a more regular lifestyle from all quarters all over again. Worse still, I was lost, writing-wise, and overall I needed an escape, through music and other diversions, none of which really bothered me, but I was bothered by what it meant for Echo. He spent the hours I was out roaming the city in the apartment, crying and looking for something, as Masha must have wandered during the nights I was in the hospital. It was, in fact, the lowest and most confused period of my life, that following the failure of the first novel, I spent it in the company of people who were, all I would soon figure out, on their own paths toward greater or lesser crises. When I finally did get home each night, or early morning, it was Echo who prompted me to cross-examine my life choices sufficiently to eventually change them. In his deep amber-green stare lay a question that seemed to transcend his simpler desire that I spend more time in my grandmother's apartment with him. As he had sensed the desperation that had driven me at my father's, so he could now look at me and wonder whether or not, since he apparently made me happy, I was not deliberately doing things elsewhere that did not make me happy. Because I soon found out that I deserved to be happy. And he was right, of course. Echo was always right. Perhaps it was those ancient Abyssinian greens and his eyes, or maybe even in his genes, trained to recognize and understand human behavior from question as basic as, are you friend or are you foe? To the moods of their masters, they gave him this power, or perhaps was those wildly early days of living first in a parking lot and then in a household that really wasn't much of an improvement that made him so sensitive. Whatever the case, my young companion was something of a genius at reading people, and he certainly read me very well. One winter I got horribly sick and had to have my tonsils removed. When they say it's surgery for better, endured as a child than as an adult, they underestimate things. I spent an entire night in the same hospital where I'd been born, choking on my own blood after a startlingly painful surgery under a local anesthetic. When I came home, I began rereading 19th and early 20th century adventure novels with echoes, upset that I was ill but delighted that I was home all through the season. He lay by and often on top of me the whole time, and when I reached Anthony's Hope, the Prisoner of Zenda, which I appreciated even more than I had as a boy, Echo, I decided, was in fact the scion of an obscure royal family. Prince Echo seemed to suit him far more than little Echo, and weak as I was, we had a wonderful time clowning in my little room in the apartment, making myself up and even making up songs about him, a habit that I would eventually revive with Masha, and both of us roaming the rest of the rooms when my grandmother was asleep. This period would eventually pay off. I couldn't anticipate how so, though. But first, after recovering, I took one last shot at making the musician and band's members' lifestyle bear fruit. But it was doomed from the start. It wasn't just that I'd come to music too late in college to ever be truly good. The deeper problem was that which plagues so many bands, the use of playing music together as a means of fabricating some sort of surrogate family. It's an attraction and a flaw in all the performing arts, ultimately false intimacy, that may relieve the dysfunctional dead spot in the participants' souls for a time, but for now, not forever. And while in the theater, television, and movies, the ugly upshot of the experience is often obviated by a set date of the project's end, in music it is a far greater problem because a band has no such built-in termination. It was plainly time for my still confused self to get out of town. Echo and I piled into an old car that I had and headed north to visit my mother, as we'd done several other times during other years together. Though neither of us knew it, however, Echo's life, like Masha's when I met her, was reaching a crisis centered on the question of feline bonding, and though Echo's decision on this score would prove very different from Masha's, it was just as wise. In the years that I'd been going through my post-think tank crisis, my mother, now the head of the same Berkshire County substance abuse program by way of which she'd gotten sober, had taken on a house in Pittsfield, the same town where I would one day bring Masha to see the lady vet. She had, without thinking, thankfully given up the house in Cherry Plain. But Echo's feelings about the countryside were not unlike those of poor old Sylvester, a fellow child of a city alley. And he much preferred the Pittsfield house. Our several prior visits there had largely been made possible by the fact that my mother had finally managed to choose as a live-in partner a man with whom I could be good friends. The partner had had a checkered life history of his own, and so there was an immediate common ground from which to work. "You need to write yourself a mystery," he'd declare to me in his Missouri accent, prophetically and repeatedly. Such wisdom was often punctuated by statements like, "Don't you worry, though, there's always one in every family who's a bum and a wino." But unlike my father, the partner's good-natured jokes in this vein were just that, good-natured, and overall the house was actually fun in an atmosphere that helped Mother and me begin to redefine our relationships. The partner had taken a great shine to Echo from their first meeting, and the feeling was mutual. They were both gregarious characters, and Echo continued to appreciate all the affection he could get, which the partner showered on him. So, on prior visits, all had gone well. I tapped away in the attic of the house, with Echo always keeping me company, as was his happy habit. But on this trip north, after so many things had changed in the city and we'd moved to Washington Square yet again, Echo often didn't show. I would call downstairs to the partner and ask if he'd seen the prince, and while sometimes he had, sometimes he hadn't, and this was cause for worry. My mother's own mother lived in an adjoining apartment, and my mother often let me know that Echo had gone there, which was odd. He hadn't shown any such curiosity before. Yet, when I called to him, loud enough, he trotted from the hall that connected the two apartments. Something was up. As I searched my grandmother's place, wondering why, for the first time, Echo hadn't eventually come when I called, I tried to stay calm. Then I found him. My grandmother had recently gotten a remarkable cat of her own, a calico beauty with medium-length fur, who was unapproachable unless she initiated the contact. An avid hunter, though, she was limited to a large backyard. Terrain, I suspect, she exceeded on many nights. She was also unafraid to give humans who presumed to try to pet her a quick, hard swipe of the paw. I'd always admired her more than hung out with her, since it was clear she decided which humans she did and did not want to befriend. And that may be why, before the night, it had never occurred to me as oddly coincidental that her name was Princess, a common name for a female cat, except when you placed it in juxtaposition to a male who had comparatively recently had princeling status conferred upon him. When I finally located the pair of them, it was enough to silence me. In one corner of the apartment, partially hidden from view, was a cat bed, Princess's cat bed, but that night, and likely for many nights previous, both she and Echo were crowded in there, wrapped in as tight an embrace as I'd ever observed in any two cats. Or indeed in any two beings, enjoy each with all four legs around the other's body. I just stood and watched them stunned for a time. They were so peacefully, soundly asleep that Echo had not heard me calling the princess and had not sensed my approach, which was not like either of them. When they finally did realize that I was standing close by, they both sat up quickly, for all the world, like two teenagers who'd been caught in a similar spot. Echo jumped over to me and bumped up against my legs, as if to assure me that this was nothing serious, that he'd still understood his priorities, but I already suspected that this was not so. I wouldn't know it for sure, however, until we returned to New York and to Washington Square. Echo popped out of his car, realized where he was, and immediately started to cry in a way my grandmother had told me he usually did when I was out. except that this time I was right in front of him. Something someone else was missing, and it was clearly breaking the big heart in Echo's undersized body. I eventually got him under control, but during the next couple of nights, he would wander the apartment plaintively, crying as though he was very much expecting someone to answer. Finally, I called my mother to ask about Princess, and sure enough, she told me that the lovely Calico had been exhibiting the same behavior ever since Echo had left. Today, I can understand the situation, though. It still hurts to do so. The bond that had initially formed between Echo and me at my father's loft had, of necessity, been insecure, because our hours together had been limited and the situation, when I wasn't there, was so unpleasant, even dangerous for him. Then at Washington Square and the several other temporary places we'd lived, the bond had remained insecure, because again, I wasn't there enough. You can leave a cat alone in your home with some food and think it's all right to depart for much of the day and most of the night, but you know, deep down, it's not. Companionship is likely the most consistently underrated of a cat's basic needs, and though a lonely cat may forgive your absence, repeat the behavior enough and, however deep feelings for you may return, however much his first choice may be that you stay with him, the bond will rarely move past insecure. It exists, but it will be the subject to refocus should something more consistent come along. And for Echo, something more consistent had at last come along. He had a house with a pleasant human company, but more importantly, he had a mate with whom he'd found he could finally form a tight, secure bond. A true companion for life was all he'd ever wanted, and now he'd discovered one among his own species, which must have gone far in repairing the experiences of his infancy and youth. I'd not yet ruled out the possibility of finding such a companion among my own species, but I had to admit the strong feeling that was such was not my destiny. I'd made, during my time with Echo, that final decision never to have children, which narrowed my chances for a long-term shared human life. With such considerations in mind, how could I fault Echo for wanting to stay among people who liked him, a fellow cat who puzzled and prized him, as his mother and brother had not? I couldn't, and so I got him into the carrier and into my car, and off we went again, north at full speed, for what I knew would be our last trip together. Our time as companions had been fairly long, but extremely checkered. Yet we were, in truth, deeply attached to each other, and I like to think that he knew as well as I did where we were and where we were going and what it meant. He seemed sad, although not for himself, his firmly fixed stare, so full of typical wisdom and love, along with his usual chatty voice, seemed expressions both of his continued knowledge that I was a creature adrift, unable to fully latch onto him or to anyone else, and of encouragement that I get about doing whenever it is a place for some sense of peace. His reunion with Princess delighted him, and I was glad, but when it was time for me to head back south alone, our goodbye was hard. Echo had been the one consistently good thing in my confused, volatile life, and now I was losing him. I would see him again, I would visit him again, and he would still jump into my lap, and even continue to stuff his head into my shirt pocket. But it didn't fit very well anymore. We loved to see each other, but I'd never given him a real home, and now he had one, and would have one for a long time. Years later, his runt status finally did catch up with him. Never the strongest of cats, he fell victim in his senior year to that terrible nemesis of all cats, urinary tract infection. I told my mother to make sure that he never got near dry food, some of which are so criminally dangerous to the feline neurological system, that they ought to be outlawed. But even this couldn't keep him safe. When he'd had just too many bouts, and I saw him during one badly swollen throughout his body and in severe pain. And when the vet my mother used advised euthanasia, she called to discuss it with me. Grateful I had to trust that the vet, who I later met and who was not needle happy, was giving good advice. Echo hadn't lived with me for several years by then, and I knew everyone involved was very sad about his end. But the pain of that kind of chronicity for a cat can no longer dodge. It is nothing to toy with, and so Echo was released. As for me, I vowed that I wouldn't get another cat until I'd somehow made a success of writing books that I was proud of and could give a feline the home attention that they all deserve. But a long period filled by work and 2 books of nonfiction, as well as countless articles of the same, stood between that decision and the phase when, in a bit of a brainstorm, I returned to those days of reading period adventure stories to Echo. I decided to combine one of my more intense side interests, criminal psychology, with history, to see if I couldn't actually make the blend work. By then, I was being paid enough for my nonfiction to live in an apartment across town back on the Lower East Side. The neighborhood itself would play a role in the next book, and its sequel. Success finally came with the first one. Sometimes I wonder if the cost of working out the solution, to Echo, to other people, to myself, hadn't been awfully high. It remained a riddle to which I still believe that Echo always knew the answer. But you can't ask anybody, much less such a prince of a cat, to wait forever while you figure it all out. Because the truth is that while everyone hopes to find their way out of such conundrums, some never do. Well, that completes the reading of the chapter on Echo in My Beloved Monster, Masha the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me by Caleb Carr. Next week, we'll read chapter 20, titled Bonded Fidelity. Hope you'll be listening then. This has been Joyce Vesper, your Sun Sounds of Arizona Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Companions on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.